This is Precepts Audio Message PA-287. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Okay, Hosea. Book of Hosea and chapter 2. Now, we had discussed that this book, Hosea, is actually in the way that the Hebrew Bible is done. It is just the first part of a book that has 12 authors. What we call the Minor Prophets was a single book. And, of course, when you were writing these on scrolls, you didn't want a whole lot of tiny little scrolls. You'd rather have one bigger one you could carry around. But we've divided them into 12 books because, of course, once we put it in the shape of our Bibles today, it really doesn't matter whether the books are short or long. But originally, this was the first of 12 minor prophets that were together in one book, the Book of the Prophets. And we discussed that Hosea means salvation, and he was a prophet to the 10 northern tribes, one of the earliest prophets. Prophesied over at least 72 years, maybe up to 6 years longer than that, possibly. And that's guessing how old he was when he started and taking him up to the destruction of Samaria as being the latest he could have prophesied. And we saw that the Lord had told him to take a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms. We talked about that didn't necessarily mean he had to marry a prostitute, but that whoredom, prostitution in this book, stands for idolatry. Because God really created us, and we have the capacity to have many, many friends and love many friends, have many people, many siblings, and even people maybe who we adopt as siblings almost, or you know, we can always love another sibling. And so forth, but there are two relationships in our lives that are meant to be exclusive. And one is the marriage relationship, and the other is our relationship with God. We're only supposed to have one marriage partner. Of course, death has made that a problem. But the way God intended us originally, we were supposed to have one marriage partner, and we're only supposed to have one God, the true God. And so adultery becomes the obvious figure for unfaithfulness to God, for idolatry. And so he is to marry a woman who is an idolater, and in fact, probably even a priestess, perhaps, of idol worship, one who is just very, very involved in idol worship. And so he marries Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and we suggest that her father and she may have both been involved in the worship of idols in the northern kingdom. That might have been their family business. And then she gave birth to children. The first one, he was to call his name Jezreel, which means either may God scatter or may God sow, a homonym. And at least initially here, the name has to do with the scattering part because he is going to avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. We talked about that Jehu, King Jehu, whom the Lord had commissioned to destroy Ahab and his family, had gone over and above the command and wiped out everyone who was connected with Ahab, not just his relatives, but all his chief officers and so forth. So we talked about the fact that Saul, of course, came under the Lord's anger because he was given a command by the Lord and didn't carry it out enough. Jehu, the Lord is angry at him because he was given a command and he carried it out and went beyond the command. But at the same time, this was generations past Jehu. So the Lord wasn't, it seems, quite so angry with Jehu as he was with Saul. In fact, he had promised Jehu 4 generations of his children on the throne. But now the time came and he said, and the house of Jehu is going to pay for the blood of Jezreel. And the bow of Israel is going to be broken in the valley of Jezreel. So Israel too is going to be punished. She has another daughter. The Lord says, call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved or not compassionated, not having mercy. Because he's not going to have mercy on Israel anymore. And then she conceived and bore another son, and he said to call his name Lo-Ammi, which means you are not my people, and I am not your God. Because he says in verse 10, the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. And we discussed this idea of Israel being not his people. And we compared 1 Kings 6:1 and the dates it gives there to Acts 13, and we saw that Acts 13 has 93 years more than 1 Kings 6:1. They don't seem to add up. So was Paul wrong, or the author of 1 Kings 6 is wrong? And I suggested that no. What we have here, there were periods where Israel became not my people in the book of Judges, where God sold them into the hands of their enemies. And if we add up all those years of captivity in the book of Judges, we find out it adds up to exactly 93 years. And we suggested that this indicates that God's clock can stop at times when he rejects Israel. His clock for Israel stops. And we live in a giant not my people period, a giant Lo-Ammi period, when his clock for Israel has stopped ever since Acts 28:28. And when this period ends, God will take up his kingdom program again, and it will be like this period had never existed. His clock will start up right where it stopped at Acts 28:28. But he says when they become his people again, the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together. So there'll be one people again. And they'll have one head. They'll have one ruler. That'll be David. And he says, great shall be the day of Jezreel. And of course, in this case, Jezreel has its opposite meaning, that God will sow. It'll sow them again in their land. So that's what we studied the last time. Now we're up to chapter 2. Verse 1. Say ye unto your brethren, Ammi, and to your sisters, Ruhamah. So we saw in chapter 1 that Isaiah had these two children. Of course, after Jezreel, his oldest boy, he had Lo-Ruhamah, his daughter, and Lo-Ammi, his son, which means not loved or not compassionated, and not my people. But now the Lord tells him to say to his brothers, Ammi, which means my people, and say to your sisters, Ruhamah, which means pitied one, compassionated one. Then he says, verse 2, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts. So he calls upon Hosea to plead with his mother. And the mother there, I think, means the mother of the nation. That would be the 10-tribe northern kingdom, and particularly personified in their capital in Samaria, would be the mother of the nation. So he says, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. And Hebrew doesn't really have a different name for wife and husband like we do in English. We are very exact about that. Hebrew just uses woman. You say my woman, a woman would say my man. You don't have a separate word for wife and husband necessarily. But certainly that, from the context, that's definitely what he means. She is not my woman, she is not my wife, neither am I her husband, I'm not her man. And you could see that clearly from the way that Israel was acting. They were acting like the Lord was not their man at all. They were rejecting him. They were going after all these idols and forgetting the Lord altogether. So he says, let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight, or from before her face. And of course he means not literally prostitution, although, as I said, often sexual deviancy went along with these idols, and it was part of the way they were worshipped. But really he means idolatry. Putting away her whoredoms out of her sight means putting away her idols out of her sight. And her adulteries from between her breasts, again, symbolizing an adulterous woman with her adulterous lover and these Israelites with their idols, whom they were loving and worshiping rather than the Lord. Verse 3, lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. So he says what he will do to her if she does not put away her whoredoms and her adulteries. He says, I will strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born. In English, we call this the birthday suit. But what does he mean by stripping her naked and setting her as in the day she was born? He says, well, I'll make her as a wilderness. Now here we see what the figure means, because of course you can't make a human being like a wilderness. Human being is not like a wilderness. And set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. So what he's talking about is the land. Him stripping her naked, setting her as in the day she was born, is stripping the land of its inhabitants, of wiping out the land, wiping out its people, making it like a wilderness and a dry land, and then slaying her with thirst. So the stripping of a land is spoken of under the figure of being stripped naked. And notice how this ties right up with what Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Because in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he talks about, starting in verse 1, for we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, and house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven, if so be that being clothed we shall not be found naked. Well, here we have this figure of being stripped naked or being clothed. And people have, modern day Platonists and traditionalists, have used this for taking off your body and being a naked soul. And they said that's naked. A naked soul is a soul without a body, whereas being clothed is a soul having a body. But notice that if we would interpret this figure according to the Old Testament, nakedness as a figure is not a figure of a soul being stripped of its body, but it's a figure of a land being stripped, of people being stripped, particularly even connected with the capital city, the mother city. But the mother city and the land being stripped. And that's what happened to Israel not long after Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. Maybe a little bit over 10 years, maybe about 12 years later, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed. And Israel was stripped naked by the Romans. And yet, that was not the end of Israel, that was not the end of Jerusalem, that was not the end of the temple, because there's another one from heaven, from God, a Jerusalem and a temple and a land in the kingdom of God that God will build and that God will establish and that men will not be able to dissolve as they did the old one. So we see this figure of nakedness in the New Testament, and if we divorce it from the old and attach it instead to our traditional ideas and our Platonic ideas and our denial of death after death, then we might think that it's talking about somebody being stripped of their body and being a naked soul. But if we take it in the context of the Bible rather than of our superstition and tradition and Greek philosophy, we would find out that being stripped naked is talking about a land and a city and a people being wiped out. And that's what he's talking about in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. But he's going to strip Israel naked, make her a wilderness, like the day she was born, like before she was inhabited. And this happened especially to Judah. It seems that the northern kingdom, soon after Assyria carried them into captivity, they imported a lot of people from other lands into the northern kingdom. But Judah, it seems, just sat empty. Became a wilderness. There was nobody living there for 70 years. Or for a number of years anyway. And so the land was stripped naked, and like in the day it was born. Verse 4, and I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. So he says, I'm not going to have mercy on the woman herself, and I'm not going to have mercy on her children. And mercy there is, again, more the idea of compassion. A lot of compassion on her children. So he's not just having his anger on the mother, but also on her offspring. So it's not just the capital city, not just the government and its leaders, but it's the people as well. The helpless, the powerless, those who are in power and those who are not in power. It's all the people of the land who are going to be destroyed, or are going to have this punishment poured out upon them. Now, as I talked about before, when the time came, we talk about Israel going into captivity, but if we would go by what happened to the majority of the people, that's not what happened. It's about 10% of the people who went into captivity. 90% of the people died. So Israel really died. If you take it, Israel as being the majority of the people, they didn't go into captivity, they died. And just a very small number of them went into captivity. So they would be slain, they would be destroyed, they would be stripped bare. And he says, why? Verse 5, for their mother hath played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, that give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. So she says, these children will be destroyed along with their mother because their mother played the harlot. She acted like a prostitute. Why? Well, she who conceived them has done shamefully. Her behavior was shameful. She said, I will go after my lovers. And again, lovers, of course, is symbolizing the idols that Israel is going after rather than the Lord. Because she claims, my lovers give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. So she credits these idols with giving her the things that she has. And that was the thing about these idols were all made to be very practical. You had one god who was the god of crops, and you worship that god or that goddess, and you get crops. And you have another, usually a goddess, who's the goddess of fertility, and you want lots of children, you want your wife's pregnant, you want her to bear successfully, you worship that goddess. And then you're going to war, and you look to the goddess of war, and you're a shepherd or a goat keeper or keep oxen, and you go to the god or the goddess who watches over those things. You go to the god of the field for your oil and for your crops there. So you're going to the gods, and these gods are supposedly watching over these different things. But notice that she's crediting her idols with what the Lord had truly given her. Because where did these things really come from? Who really gave her her bread and her water, her wool and her flax, her oil and her drink? Well, those things came from the Lord. Those are the blessings of the true God. And these idols that she credited with being the god of this or the goddess of that, they had nothing to do with it. Those idols were imaginary things. That's why the Lord calls them vanity, emptiness, is because, of course, the point of the statue is the statue is supposed to represent a god or goddess who is behind the statue. But the Lord says there is no god or goddess behind the statue. The statue is empty. It claims to represent some god or goddess, and yet the god or goddess it claims to represent doesn't exist. So it's just an empty thing. You're just worshiping the piece of rock or the piece of wood or whatever it is you made the idol out of. That's all you're worshiping. There's no god or goddess behind it at all. But they're crediting their lovers, they're crediting these gods and goddesses with giving them the good things of life. And saying, well, I've got to worship the god of crops, or what will happen to my crops? I've got to worship the goddess of fertility, or my wife might miscarry. I've got to worship the god of flocks and herds, or my flocks and herds, something bad will happen to them. And when things seem to go well, they credit their gods and goddesses. And when things go badly, well, then they just figure, well, I've got to give more to the god or goddess. You know, they don't say, well, maybe I shouldn't worship these things at all. They say, oh, I just must not have done enough. The god or goddess must be angry with me. I've got to give them more to appease them. So they're crediting these idols. They're going after these idols because they think they give them all these things. Verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her paths. So he says, because she has done all these things and has credited all these things to her idols, to her lovers, he says, I will hedge up your way with thorns. I'll surround your path with thorns. I'll make things bad for you. And I will make a wall. In Hebrew, that is, I will wall a wall. In other words, build up a wall that she shall not find her paths. So I'll wall off the good path she's been walking on so she can't find it. So since she credits her idols with all these good things I give her, I'll surround her path with thorns and I'll put a wall across the good path so that she can't find it. Verse 7, and she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband. For then was it better with me than now. So when these bad things start to happen to her, he says, she will follow after her lovers. Like I said, she'll just go all the more after her gods and goddesses because she'll figure she needs to appease them somehow. Get back the good things she's lost. But it won't work. She won't overtake them. She'll try to follow them. She won't be able to overtake them. She won't be able to catch up to them. She won't be able to get them to give her the things she wants. She'll seek them, but she'll not find them. She'll seek their help and their aid, but no help, no aid will come. So he says, then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband. Of course, by that, he means himself, the Lord, the God who they had originally had. For then was it better with me than now. Now notice here the similarity of these words to the words of the prodigal son. Remember the prodigal son, when he was off in the faraway land, squandered all his wealth, and then a famine came. He ended up in the pig pen feeding the pigs, wishing he could eat the food they were eating, and nobody would even give him that. It says he came to himself and said, I'll go and return to my father. Don't even the lowliest servants in my father's house, aren't they well fed? So I'll go back to him. It was better for me then than now. Well, that's what Israel is going to say. I'll go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. Verse 8, for she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. So he says that she didn't know, she didn't realize. Of course, this was the culture that she grew up with, because Israel did not cast the idolatrous nations out of their land as they were supposed to, because they made leagues with them and lived among them. They got curious about their religion and learned about all these practical, helpful sounding gods and goddesses and started to worship them. And adopted this idea that these gods and goddesses help give you all these things. Well, I can worship the Lord, but I better not stop worshiping these gods and goddesses or things will go bad in this and in that. So she was ignorant. She didn't understand the truth, which was that these gods and goddesses never gave her anything. He never got a single thing from them. Rather, he says, it was I who gave her corn. Now, when we hear the word corn, we think of the American maize, which is what we have now specialized the word corn to mean. But corn in Old English, long before the U.S. with its maize was even discovered, corn was just a word for grain. It was a generic word for all grain. And we've just specialized it to mean maize. So in the English they're using in the King James Version, corn just means grain. I gave her her grain and her wine. Of course, that's the fruit of the vine. Grain standing for food, wine standing for drink, and then the oil. And oil was often used, among other things, for covering the smell. It's kind of like perfume or cologne. That they didn't have so much water to bathe with, but they would cover themselves with oil. And it was used for other things, too. It was used in lamps. It was used for light. Many useful ways they used oil. Many necessary ways they used oil. So he says, I gave her these things, their corn, their wine, their oil. Now, all three words here are different than the words in verse 5, interestingly. But I think the implication is clear, even though it's different words. He's saying, I was the one who gave her all the things, the good things that she had. And she didn't even realize it. She thought her lovers, her idols, were giving her these things. And moreover, he says, he multiplied her silver and gold. I gave her her wealth. And what did she do with that wealth? She prepared it for Baal. She prepared it for Baal, meaning the lords, the master idols. Baal meant lord or master. So these master idols that they had, they took the silver and gold the Lord gave them, and they just prepared it to worship these Baals. So their foolish thinking, they didn't realize the truth. They were convinced of the efficacy of these idols and didn't even realize when the idols stopped producing that they had never produced. It was the Lord all along. So even, I think, in verse 7, when they said, I'll go back to my first husband, they still didn't go back figuring, well, it turned out those idols didn't really exist. It wouldn't really help. They just went back thinking, well, the idols got mad at me and wouldn't help anymore, so I'll go back to the Lord. They didn't realize there was the Lord the whole time. Verse 9. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof, and will recover my wool and my flax, given to cover her nakedness. So he says, therefore will I return. And notice this return versus their return in verse 7. So he says, therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof. And again, of course, corn there is grain, not the American maize, which they didn't have, but grain. I will take away my grain in the time thereof, in the time it's normally harvested, and my wine in the season thereof, in the time when it's normally harvested, and will recover. That word would also mean plunder or seize. Will seize my wool and my flax, given to cover her nakedness. Now again, these things, he's using a symbol of stripping a woman naked, but really means he's stripping the land. He's stripping the land of its crops, of its flocks and herds, of its produce. Verse 10, and now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of mine hand. So he says that he will discover her lewdness. He'll show up her unfaithfulness to himself. He'll display it for all to see in the sight of her lovers, right before her idols. And what will happen while Israel is being conquered and stripped naked and punished? Well, those idols will sit there on their stands and in their temples and on every rooftop, and they'll sit there in the same position. They'll sit there smiling. They'll sit there doing whatever form they were carved in, while their people are being killed right in front of them, and they won't do a thing. They'll just sit there happily watching like they always do, and won't save Israel at all. So right before their, right in the sight, in other words, right before the eyes, of course he's speaking figuratively there because the idols can't really see, but they imagine that they did, and right before those idols, right before her lovers, they are going to be, their lewdness, their unfaithfulness to the Lord is going to be discovered. And he says, and none shall deliver out of my hand. None of those idols will be able to rescue Israel from the Lord when he brings punishment upon them. Verse 11, I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. So notice again here that the woman symbolizes the nation. He says, I will also cause all her mirth to cease. He's not talking about a woman, of course, he's talking about the nation. Their happy times, her feast days, her festivals, her holidays, as we call them, her new moons. And the new moon for them, because they had real moons. Our months are more or less just fictional. But they had real moons according to the cycles of the moon. And they would celebrate every new moon as the start of the month. But he's going to take those away. And then her Sabbaths. Her Sabbaths were the weekly Sabbath day that they would celebrate. And all her solemn feasts, all her solemn celebrations. So all these times of celebration, all these times of remembrance, all these times of Israel enjoying themselves or celebrating or worshiping, these all will be taken away as they are taken off into captivity and or destroyed. Verse 12, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. So he is going to destroy her vines and her fig trees. Again, these are fruit-producing plants, vines and figs. And they would get produce, and they would get a lot of good crops from these things. He says, I'm going to destroy them, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me. But really the word there is the word for hire, as would be the word that would be used for the price of a harlot or a prostitute. So she says, these are my hire. This is my price that I've gotten for prostituting myself with these idols. I worship these idols, and they gave me these vines, and they gave me these fig trees. Again, in their idea, this practical religion of you worship the god of this, and he gives you this, and you worship the goddess of that, and she gives you that. So if I want good vines and fig trees, if I want my vines to produce grapes, I worship the god of vines, or the god of wine, and so forth. If I want to good figs, I worship the goddess of fig trees, or whatever it might be. And so she said, these are my hires that my lovers gave me. Well, he says, I'm going to destroy those, and I will make them a forest. Instead of these nice cultivated trees, it's just going to be a forest in their place. And the beasts of the field shall eat them. What remains of these fruit-producing trees, the animals will get to eat them, but the people will not. Verse 13, and I will visit upon her the days of Baalim, wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers and forgot me, saith the Lord. So he says that he will visit upon her. And to visit is, of course, symbolic there, or its meaning there is that he will bring these things upon her. When you go to visit someone in this sense, you go to perhaps give them what they deserved. I mean, we would usually think of it the opposite way. If you think of somebody going to court, they visit the court, and the court brings the punishment upon them. But in this case, the court comes to you. It would be more like the arrest, where the law comes to visit you. That's the kind of visit we're talking about here. It's like when you get a visit with an arrest warrant. So I will visit upon her. I'll come to bring upon her her punishment. So I'll visit upon her the days of Baalim. So all those days where they took the Lord's silver and the Lord's gold and the good things the Lord gave them, and they used those things to worship Baal, he says, I'm going to bring those days back on their own heads. I'm going to return upon them what they did. All those days when they burnt incense to the Baals. And remember, I-M in Hebrew is the same as S in English. It just makes it a plural. So Baalim is just Baals, is how we would put it in English, because we'd make it an S rather than an I-M. I'll visit upon her the days of the Baals, wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers, and forgot me, saith the Lord. So she fancied herself up, she put on earrings and jewels to go after these lovers. And we can imagine the people, and even people today, like to dress up for religious things. I've noticed on a church where they would occasionally have the communion service, and I would see the girls, the women, dress up more on that day than they would on other days, because, oh, this day we're going to have the communion service. So that annoyed me. But the fact is, people like to dress up for their religious services, their religious rituals, so they dressed up. And of course, they also dressed up the idols. They gave the idols gifts of earrings and jewels and so forth. So she went after her lovers, her idols, and she forgot the Lord. So this was the sad truth of the past, what the Lord was going to do to Israel for their idolatry. But we take a turn, we take a change in tone and in focus when we come to verse 14. So we have descended to destruction up through verse 13, but now we are going to ascend into the kingdom, and we're going to see these things undone starting in verse 14. When he says, verse 14, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her." So because Israel is going to be stripped and made naked, and the people sent into captivity, the ones who survived sent into captivity, they will be scattered and they will be far away from the Lord, their former husband. But someday he's going to come back to Israel. Now, not the same Israel. Of course, Israel many thousands of years later. But he's going to come back and find Israel, and Israel will still be there. And he will come and he will allure her. Again, using the figure of Israel as a woman. This woman, after she's cast off, he's going to come and he's going to allure her and bring her into the wilderness. And the wilderness in the Bible is the place of separation. So he's going to separate her from all others. He's going to separate Israel from the other nations. He's going to separate Israel from their former life. And I believe this will happen at the start of the kingdom. And one of the first things God will do is that he will, first of all, he will identify all the Israelites. I don't think everyone today who thinks they're a Jew really is. And on the other hand, everyone who thinks they're not a Jew, some of them might be. They've just forgotten. But God will identify who is an Israelite and who is not in his sight. And he will tell them that they're an Israelite, and he will demand that they come to this great gathering in the wilderness. I don't think this gathering will be in the land of Israel. I think if I had to guess, I would guess it will be at the Mount Sinai, where he gathered them before under Moses. He's going to gather Israel to come and meet him in the wilderness. And he's going to separate them from all nations. He's going to separate them, like I said, from their former lives. If they've been living in the United States, well, they're going to have to leave the United States. If they've been living in Europe, they're going to have to leave Europe. If they've been living in Russia, they're going to have to leave Russia. Wherever they've been living, they're going to have to leave that place. They're going to have to leave that life behind. They're going to have to separate and go into the wilderness to the Lord. But when they go there, he's going to speak comfortably unto her. And speak comfortably means he's going to speak words of love. He's going to speak from the heart. He's going to tell them he loves them. And that will be quite a thing to happen to Israel. Especially, I think, as they discover that Jesus Christ really was their Messiah after all. That many of them will be quaking in their boots and figuring that whatever they get from God at this point, he'll pour out his wrath on them. Maybe this is the end of them. And the last thing they'll be expecting of God is from God, perhaps, is words of love. And yet that is what he says he's going to speak to them. He's going to explain to them his love for them. I suppose many of them, as they've lived in this time of God's silence, in this time when God is not judging, this time when God has not been favoring Israel, they've seen all the bad things that's happened to the nation and how God hasn't stepped in to save them. Many of them have perhaps not really believed that God loves Israel all that much. Yet God is going to speak his love to them, and he's going to inform them of his love for them. And I think for many that will be quite a surprise and quite a revelation. Then verse 15, "And I will give her her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt." So he says, "I will give her her vineyards." Now, giving gifts is another way to win a woman. If a man is trying to romance a woman, one thing he can do is speak words of love, speak from the heart. Another thing he can do is give her gifts. That's what the Lord's going to do. He's going to speak his love to her. Then he's going to give her gifts. He's going to give her her vineyards from there. So he's going to give her back her land. And it's not going to be a strip land, a desert land, an arid land. Israel, it's amazing. It really wasn't good for much of anything until the Jews moved in there, and they've made it into quite a garden spot again, many of the places there, through their efforts and through technology and through good cultivation and practices and so forth. They've restored much of the land, but that'll be nothing compared to when God restores it. And when God gives them back the land of milk and honey, which Israel has not been since the time of her captivity. So he's going to give her her vineyards from there. Then he says he's going to give her the valley of Achor for a door of hope. Now Achor means trouble or pressure. So he's going to give her her vineyards, her rich land again. Then he's also going to give her the valley of trouble or pressure for a door of hope. And I believe that we see right here that Israel is giving a blessing before the Great Tribulation. He's going to bless her and then lead her through the valley of trouble. So that proves that Israel is restored and blessed before and not after the tribulation. In the prophetic scheme of many people, Israel goes through the tribulation and then he brings them back to himself and gives them their land back and everything. Now at this point he says he brings them to him, he speaks words of love to them, he gives them their vineyards, and he gives them the Valley of Achor for a door of hope, a door of expectation. So he gives that to them, so the trouble comes after the giving, the trouble comes after the alluring. The tribulation comes after the restoration of Israel, not before it. But even then, the tribulation is not a time of terror, and it is a time of trouble, it is a time of pressure, but it's not the worst time ever or a horrible thing, or it makes the Holocaust look like nothing, like a lot of people have tried to make out. No, it's a door of hope, it's a door of expectation, because beyond the valley of trouble is even a closer relationship with the Lord and even a closer walk with him. So the tribulation is not this thing of horror for Israel, but it's a door of hope. And as she, because she has been allured, because she's been convinced of God's love, because she's been given all these gifts, when she comes to the Valley of Trouble, she's not going to be troubled by it. She's going to sing there. Because she's going to know she has a husband. She's going to know she's has a God who's with her, even in the Valley of Trouble. So she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as when she was young, as when she was confident in the Lord. And as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Now, if we think of Israel coming up out of the land of Egypt, we can think of two peoples. We can think of that people who were the older generation who came out of Egypt, who never did seem to trust the Lord, who were always griping and complaining against him, who would never want to do what he said until he punished them. But we can also think of that younger generation who came up seeing the Lord's blessing and favor in the wilderness, and who entered the land, and who was faithful, and who trusted the Lord, and the Lord through them conquered the land. And so I think those are more the people we're to think of here, who sang, who trusted in the Lord, who said in the words of the psalm that though 1,000 fall at your side and 10,000 fall at your right hand, it will not come near you. And he said what an amazing thing it must have been to be that younger generation. And say you're traveling through the wilderness and a band of raiders attacks. And the arrows fly and they hit the older generation, but not one of them hits one of the younger generation. Plague comes and strikes the camp. Strikes the older generation, not a single member of the younger generation gets sick. Wild beast jumps out of the bushes. Who does it attack? Does it attack one of the younger generation? No, never. The older generation, every time. And they got to see what it meant to be blessed by the Lord and what it meant to be punished by the Lord. And so they learned to trust the Lord. They learned with the Lord on their side, no trouble can come near you. They learn that. And Israel, when they get to the tribulation, will have learned the same lesson. They'll be able to sing there. They'll be able to say, this trouble will not come near me. And even if I have to go through trouble, even if I have to go through pressure, yes, even if I die in this tribulation, God will just raise me back to life. And this trouble, I don't have to worry about it. I can sing. I can trust him. I can march with confidence through the valley of trouble because the Lord is with me. So what a contrast Israel in that day will be with Israel in the past, trusting in and clinging to their worthless idols, even as those idols brought them down into destruction. Verse 16, "And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, and shalt call me no more Baali." So he says, in that day, and again, that's the day when this comes, the day of the premillennial kingdom of God. He says, in that day thou shalt call me Ishi. And Ish is the word for man or male person. So you'll call me my man. But again, in the context here, since they didn't really have a word for husband, in the context here I think clearly it means that you'll call me my husband. And that being a term of endearment, a term of love, a term of closeness. "And shalt no more call me Baali," which would mean my master. So in other words, she's getting closer to him. She's getting closer to God. She calls him her husband now rather than her master. He says, verse 17, "For I will take away the names of Baalim out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name." So he says that he will take away the names of the Baals, of the master idols, out of her mouth. So he's using the fact, of course, this word Baal, like I said, it means Lord or master. It could be applied to God, but they were much more commonly applying it to these idols of theirs and calling these idols Baals. This is the Lord of this, and this is the Lord of that. This is the master of war, and this is the master of strength, and this is the master of this and the master of that. So he says, I'm going to take away the name of the Baals, of the lords, out of their mouths. They're not going to be speaking these names and say, oh, master of this, oh, master of that, help me, save me, and so forth. They're not going to do that anymore. They shall no more be remembered by their name. Now, does that mean that people will forget what these idols were called? Well, not necessarily. A lot of them have their names in the scripture. They have their names in the Bible. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll forget the names of these idols. But it means they'll be no more remembered by their reputation. Your name is the reputation that you have. The Bible says a good name is more to be desired than great riches. What does that mean? Well, I really like Samuel, but Jackson, so I'd rather have Samuel, that's a good name. No, that's not what it means. It's not talking about a good cognomen, a good name people call you when they not want to know they're talking to you. It's talking about a reputation. So these Baals will no more be remembered by their reputation. No one will think of the Baal of war as really being able to benefit anybody in war. Nobody will think of the Baal of wine as really being able to bring in the grape crops. No one will think of that anymore. They'll just think of them as these empty, worthless, made-up things that were an insult to God and made fools out of the people who worship them. That's all they think of them. So this reputation that these gods and these idols had as being so helpful and being so useful and doing all these things for you, those reputations will be forgotten. And the idols will just be thought of with scorn and as an embarrassment. So these idols will not be remembered by their reputation anymore. Verse 18, "And in that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground. And I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and I will make them to lie down safely." So he says, in that day he will make a covenant. And literally in Hebrew it is that he will cut a covenant. And that's the terminology that's always used. And that's because covenants always involved the sacrificing of an animal. You'd kill the animal, you'd cut the animal up into parts, and then the two people making the covenant would pass between the parts of the animal. And that was their way of solemnizing the covenant, the agreement, is that they would pass between the parts. So making a covenant, it's like we would talk about signing an agreement. Well, what does taking a pen and writing down your name on a piece of paper have to do with making an agreement? Well, nothing really. It's just that becomes the symbol. That piece of paper states what the agreement is going to be, and you signing your name on it becomes the symbol. Anybody else could write the name on there and it doesn't mean anything, but you writing your name on there means you've agreed to this agreement. That's our way of doing it. Well, for them, it was cutting apart this animal and passing between the parts. That was how the two parties said we're entering into this agreement. If one passed through the parts and the other refused to, then there'd be no agreement. So just like we talk about signing an agreement, that doesn't make any sense, because what does signing have to do with agreeing to anything? In the same way, cutting a covenant, well, that doesn't make sense. What does cutting something have to do with agreeing with something? Well, nothing, except that was the symbol they used. So just like signing your name is the symbol we use. So he says, I will cut a covenant for them with the beast of the field. So he says, I'm going to cause the animals of the field to be in an agreement with them, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground. And we read about more about that in Isaiah, that the wild animals, that the fierce animals will no longer be fierce. That you won't have to worry about lions, that a little child would be able to reach into the snake's hole and pull the snake out, and the snake wouldn't hurt him. That the wolf and the lambs would lie down in the field together, and the lambs wouldn't worry about the wolves, and the wolves wouldn't want to eat the lambs. Of course, we always think of the lion and the lamb because somebody thought that would sound a lot cooler in their song than a wolf and a lamb. But the Bible talks about the wolf and the lamb. And so he says it's going to be a covenant cut with them and with the beasts of the field. And so there will be peace between men and animals, no more fierce wild animals. And I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth. He'll bring an end to warfare, and he'll bring an end to the weapons of the war. He will bring an end to war on earth. And so with no wild animals and with no wild people, he will make them to lie down safely. And why do we have to have weapons and protection? Well, because of wild animals and wild people. That's why we need these things. And yet he says there'll be no need of them anymore, because there will be a covenant between you and the animals, and there will be no more warfare. So they will be safe at that time. Verse 19, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercies. So he says that he will betroth them to him for the outflow. So they will be betrothed. They will be his betrothed wife. And as I've talked about in the Hebrew culture, that you were legally husband and wife when you were betrothed. We always compare betrothal to engagement because that's what we have. But there's nothing legal about an engagement. We aren't legal till the marriage. But a betrothal was a legal engagement. It took a divorce to break it. So he says, you'll be betrothed to me for the outflow. Well, does that really mean they're betrothed forever and they never get married? That's like, you think about it, it's kind of funny, like Mickey Mouse, for example. How long has Mickey been around? Since the 20s? And of course, they created a girlfriend, Minnie, for him. But he and Minnie are always dating. You notice they never get engaged, they never get married. They're just always, the poor Mickey never gets married. Poor Minnie. They've just been dating for decades. Same thing with Donald and Daisy. They just keep on dating forever. Well, is the Lord just going to be betrothed to Israel forever and never marry them? Well, no, I think the marriage supper of the Lamb, when does that take place? That takes place in the new heavens and the new earth. So they're betrothed. So see, forever doesn't mean forever, does it? They're betrothed throughout the kingdom eon, and I think throughout the eon of the parousia, the 1,000 years. But the marriage supper of the Lamb then takes place at the new heavens and the new earth. So their betrothal doesn't last forever, it lasts for the outflow. It lasts for the flow of the kingdom and the flow of the parousia, and then the marriage takes place of the new heavens and new earth. So forever is not a good translation of olam. It means for the outflow. And the olam is often another name for the kingdom. So they will be betrothed to the Lord throughout the kingdom. And they will be betrothed to him in righteousness and in judgment. So in righteousness. So it will be a righteous betrothal. And it will be betrothal in judgment. It will be judgment. Judging, remember, is setting in order. We so often get this idea that judgment means punishment. But no, the Lord's judgments is the Lord's order, the Lord's setting things in order. And to judge means to determine what's right and then set things right, according to the determination you've made. So they'll be betrothed to him in righteousness, and they'll be betrothed to him in judgment, and they'll be betrothed to him in loving kindness, and they'll be betrothed to him in mercies. So in righteousness and judgment and in loving kindness and mercy. So it's not, he's not a harsh betrothed husband. He is not a cruel betrothed husband. No, he betroths them in loving kindness and in mercy. But also in righteousness and in judgment. So it's goodness, righteousness, loving kindness, and mercy. Verse 20, I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. So they will be betrothed to him in steadiness. And Israel in the past was anything but steady. They did not stick with the Lord. Even if one generation would turn toward him, the next generation would turn away again. That's the problem in this life. That each generation comes around, and they're young and dumb and empty heads, and they make the same mistakes their parents did. They don't learn from their parents. Or maybe they do in some things, but not in others, or maybe they make some mistakes their parents never thought of or didn't think to warn them about. And we just go the same cycle over and over and over again. You have to learn their lesson, or maybe they don't. The same battle over and over again. Is this generation going to follow the Lord or not? And yet in this case, it's going to be steady. It's going to be steady. It's not going to be, for one thing, it's not going to be one generation taking the place of another. It'll just be each generation will be added onto the ones before it, because there will be births, but there won't really be deaths. So there will be steadiness, there will be stability in this betrothal. And the result is, he says, and thou shalt know the Lord. And this knowledge here is experiential knowledge. It's not just information. They'll know about the Lord. Because you can know about the Lord, but no, this will be, they will know him personally. They will get to know him like a betrothed wife getting to know her future husband. Verse 21, and it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. So he says, in that day, of course meaning at that time, he will hear. And hearing means more just that he hears the sound. Oh, anybody who is a wife probably knows that sometimes her husband hears her voice, but he's not listening. And maybe husbands know that about wives too. That you can be talking, the other person can be in audible range, and their ear is obviously registering the sound, but they're not hearing. But the Lord is going to hear, and he's going to answer. He's going to listen. He's going to act on it. So that day he's going to hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. So the heavens will hear the earth, and the earth will hear, and the Lord will hear the heavens. Verse 22, and the earth shall hear the corn, and the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. So the Lord is going to answer the heavens. Now, what are the? Now, remember, heaven doesn't have to mean places. That heaven can mean people. Heaven is the exalted place, but heavens, especially when it's plural, can also mean exalted people. And those who are his heavens, his governors, his rulers on earth and the kingdom, the Lord will always hear them. And they will hear the land. So often in our day, our rulers don't want to hear the land. They don't want to hear the will of the people. Certainly a lot of people in Washington right now who don't want to hear what the people said to them in the last election. They would rather ignore it and keep doing what they want to do. And the heavens don't always hear the land. But the Lord will hear the heavens, and the heavens will hear the land. And the land will hear the corn and the wine and the oil. They will, the land itself will hear and will answer the grain and the wine and the oil. And again, corn means grain, not American maize, of course. So this, the land will be producing its crop. And I think that could be the literal land will produce its crops. We know in the kingdom it talks about the sower over, or the reaper overtaking the sower. That the crops are so good and come in so fast that I think that's probably an exaggeration to make a point. But the crops will come in so fast, the reaper will almost catch up with the sower. And yet also I think the produce on earth will be in righteousness and judgment, loving kindness and in mercy, like we had in verse 19, that the earth will be bringing forth the produce that the Lord always wanted from the earth. It says, and they shall hear Jezreel. The people of the land will hear Jezreel. And so we're coming back to the same to blessing for the same destroyed place. Remember back in chapter 1, Jezreel was going to be destroyed and punished. But now Jezreel is going to be doesn't mean scattered, it means sown or planted. That homonym, that word that has two meanings, Jezreel. And it's also connected with Israel. Jezreel is connected with Israel, the people of Israel. Of course, it's a city in Israel. So the land will hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and the land will hear Jezreel. Then verse 23, and I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people. And they shall say, thou art my God. So the Lord says that he will sow her unto me in the earth. So he will sow Israel to himself in the land. And he will have mercy upon her that have not obtained mercy. This people of Israel who didn't get his mercy, that he poured out his wrath upon in the past because of their wickedness, well, now they will obtain that mercy that they didn't get in the past. And now he will say to those who are not his people, we cast off as not his people, he will say to them, you are my people. So he'll say to those who are low Ami, he will say to them, Ami. He will say to those that have not obtained compassion, you will have mercy on, you will have compassion on those who have not obtained compassion. You will say to those who are low Ami that you are now Ami. And they will say, my God, my Elohim, my Creator. And they will recognize him at that time. They'll no longer recognize these idols. They'll recognize the true God. So this is quite a chapter. It starts out with the sad fall of Israel in the past and their casting off, their destruction, their scattering among all lands, a scattering that has never been completely reversed in spite of the return in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. That return was not universal, and they were never restored like they were before. Yet in the future, he will return them. He will restore them. And we realize that through the resurrection, many of those same people who were cast off and destroyed will be returned, and he will have mercy and compassion upon them in the kingdom. So the darkness of Israel's destruction is offset by the blazing light of Israel's restoration in the kingdom of God. So that is an amazing chapter, and chapter 3 is an amazing chapter as well, teaching more about the final restoration of Israel. But we're out of time for today. We'll take up again in Hosea chapter 3 in our next study.